Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our discussion today is geoengineering and the failed efforts to curb climate change, its blowback on the environment, methane threats, and the government's efforts to mask, to hide, to cover up the severity of our climate change crisis. We are also going to separate out fact from fiction. There are many stories about geoengineering and its association with different illnesses, including what is called the cloud flu, where it's heavily sprayed areas and people coming down with upper respiratory tract infections. Is that real or not real? And we're also going to talk about Morgellons disease. Now, I've worked with people with Morgellons, and if you've never seen it, it is like something out of a science fiction film. A person, well, maybe it's in their arm. It can be anywhere. I've even seen it in the eye. But suddenly little tentacles come out. And if you feel them, they feel like glass. And you can pull them, and you could pull it out. And there could be a dozen of them. And yet they are not normal. They're not a part of any of the DNA we've ever seen. Some say it's weaponized material. Some say for years they've denied it exists. Now medical doctors are actually treating it. So we'll ask my guest, Dane Wigington, who's out in California in the Mount Shasta region, about this. Dane is a geoengineering scientist with a background in solar energy. He is highly regarded as one of the foremost experts and commentators on stratospheric aerosol geoengineering and solar radiation management. He's a former employee of Bechtel Power Corporation and worked for the first commercial solar plants in the United States. As a climate scientist researcher, Dane has been studying the issues of geoengineering and chemtrails for a long time. He's appeared in numerous documentary films and public appearances educating the public about the adverse effects of weather modification. He is featured in Michael Murray's documentary, Why in the World Are They Spraying? He lives on his wildlife preserve near Lake Shasta in Northern California, and it was through his observations in the change of the forest and the atmosphere and biodiversity and the health of the land that alerted him to the implications of excessive geoengineering operations in his region. Dane hosts the weekly radio broadcast Global Alert News, a very popular program, on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and directs the website geoengineeringwatch.org for the latest updates and commentaries on geoengineering science and its adverse effects. He is not a conspiratorial theorist. He's very grounded. He challenges those who make unsupportable statements, as we challenge those that make unsupportable statements in science or nutrition or health, for a simple reason. Because now there is an enormous campaign underway to either censor, delete, block, or in any way they can expunge those who are truly progressive in science and politics and in different fields from the websites. And they're succeeding. And unfortunately, what they will do, and it's very clever, they will take a person like Alex Jones, and who makes some completely false and non-supportable statements, whether you like him or not for his bombast and his intemperate behavior. He had a large audience, and now it's doubled since he's been censored, but they took him off the air. Now, for those of us who believe that even if you disagree with someone and their opinions, the moment you open that door to censoring that person, then think of all the other people who are completely legitimate, are not filled with bombast and egomania, who present real well-grounded arguments, who are thrown off at the same time. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Every day, I'm given reports of very credible people, outstanding reputations, never said a statement that wasn't verifiable, who have been banned by Facebook or deleted, or the algorithms have been affecting their reach, so they're not reaching anyone. They're broadcasting, but they're not reaching anyone compared to what they used to. So one of the good things about Dane is the information he's going to share with us, you could take into a court of law. Earlier, last week, he appeared for a brief interview on my program. The people liked it. We had an enormous outpouring saying, have him on for an hour, and hence he's here. Nice to have you with us again, Dane.
Thank you, Gary. Hope you can hear me well in this particular location I'm at because of the fires here in our region. I've had to be mobile right now, but hopefully you can hear me okay.
All right. Well, although we discussed the first topic last week, I'd like to revisit briefly as a starting point because we have a huge worldwide audience right now who did not hear you. So a week ago it was announced California is having its worst wildfire season in history. The three worst fires in California history are blazing right now. There are a minimum of 21 major fires and dozens of minor fires just in California. There are through many other states as well. And the fires continue to be at record pace, including the one that's growing right as we speak in Mendocino, along with the Northern California coast. And characteristically, long periods of drought and dryness associated with global warming are most often stated as the primary factors for western forest wildfires. But your ongoing studies and personal research in Northern California, which is witnessing the worst fires, show strong evidence that excessive geoengineering is also a contributing factor to these fires. So how does geoengineering make forests more prone towards fires? And then please speak about the adverse effects of these weather-changing chemicals and aerosols that they're spraying upon trees, foliage, and grasses. And also they go into streams, the rivers, the lakes. And this is where cattle graze, people raise crops, where animals forage. And what, if any, impact do we know it's having on them as well? The form is yours. Take your time.
Thank you, Gary. In regard to the forest fires, which, again, are burning all over the world, not just in California. We have British Columbia, Alaska, Siberia, Norway, Sweden. We now, as of last week, have peer-reviewed study to prove that the rate of wildfire burning in, for example, Siberia has increased 1,000%, 10 times worse in the last 10 years. These statistics are staggering, absolutely staggering. And this is where climate engineering must be put into the equation. When we have the entire climate science community and organizations like the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the largest scientific body ever put together on any subject in human history, not only not considering methane or feedback loops in any of their modeling, which invalidates all of their modeling by itself, they will not acknowledge, like the rest of academia, the climate engineering elephant in the room, or in the sky in this case. It's a very bad career decision for them to do so, or worse, many of these agencies have signed non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements. We have an illegal federal gag order right now on all National Weather Service and all NOAA employees. Governments around the globe are trying desperately to mask the fact that they have completely derailed the climate system. And this is on top of anthropogenic warming as a whole. Obviously, we know we've been incredibly horrible stewards of the planet. This is the current administration, the worst of all. And one could never begin to quantify all the sources of anthropogenic damage. But the intentional intervention in the climate system, the single biggest factor of all mathematically in regard to the destruction it's causing. So back to your question of how is climate engineering most related to forest fires? We must have more rain on a warming planet. The laws of physics make that clear. The atmosphere holds 7% more moisture for every degree C of warming. It has to rain more, and it's not. This is not to say there's not deluges happening. There is, of course. But overall, we have a reduction in atmospheric relative humidity. How can that possibly be? The reason is because of climate engineering. And anybody who searches this, I ask no one to believe me, search geoengineering drought, and you'll find major science institutions acknowledging the drought-causing effects of climate engineering, light-scattering particles to block some of the sun's incoming thermal radiation. That disrupts the evaporative cycle. That disrupts the hydrological cycle. Thus, we have unbelievably protracted droughts. the particulates in the atmosphere being sprayed from jet aircraft as part of the climate engineering operations, a primary aspect of those operations, are destroying the ozone layer. Lots of science study to back up what I'm stating. That is an unavoidable effect of climate engineering. So back to the forest fires on the U.S. or the North American West Coast, we have NASA satellite imagery to prove there are massive spraying operations occurring in the entire Eastern Pacific every single day. You have to see these photos to believe them, Gary, and they're available at geoengineeringwatch.org. That's disrupting and, in essence, cutting off any flow of moisture to the entire North American West Coast. We can speculate as to all the agendas being carried out by these operations, but the fact that these operations are the single greatest causal factor for the protracted droughts with the ridiculous resilient ridge of high pressure, which the meteorologists are all perplexed as to how this can be happening, all this part of climate engineering. So between cutting off the moisture, toxifying soils, because we know the aluminum's in the rain, we have lab tests from all over the Western U.S., all over the globe to prove that. That kills the trees from the bottom up, UV killing it from the top down. Again, the protracted drought, not a natural scenario. And we have an incendiary dust, Gary. These particles used with climate engineering, named in the patents, showing up in our lab test, aluminum nanoparticulates, barium, strontium. These are incendiaries which coat the foliage, which coat the soils, the surface, all the combustibles. So from every direction, climate engineering is the elephant in the sky that is not being acknowledged by agencies, and unfortunately, Gary, I'll give the mic back to you, not environmental groups either. Why? Because for the environmental groups to speak about this issue risks what they feel, in their own words to our attorneys at Geoengineering Watch, it risks their 501c3 nonprofits, and they're not willing to risk those nonprofits. So in the meantime, the most environmentally destructive human practice of all rages on.
Thank you for that oversight. Again, Dane is talking to us from a remote area of Northern California in the Shasta region, and there are fires around there. Before I go to my next issue I'd like for you to address, just a few very practical points that will hopefully help you if you haven't taken this into consideration and others in this audience in other parts of the world. Remember, we have people listening from the Middle East and Africa where they're also facing drought. In Florida now, where I have my sanctuary, Animals Recovery and Rescue Sanctuary, in the summertime it rains every day, but in the wintertime you can go 3 or 4 months without a drop of water. As a result, all that green foliage and lushness in the summer becomes just absolute tinder for fires in the winter and before it hits the summer or the spring rains. So every year now, there's greater and greater volume of fires, number of fires, so many that the county will tell you that they can't fight all the fires. There's just not enough equipment, so they choose a few of the fires. As a result, I've seen every year now for the past 3 years, fires coming right up by my property. In fact, there was a beautiful animal sanctuary just a mile and a half from mine, burned it to the ground last year. And so here are some suggestions for you and everyone else in the audience. One, get a 4-inch hose, water hose, and ideally have a 4-inch well. And then you put your cap onto that and you run it up the side of your house. If you have a barn as well, and you run it across the roof. And you put little perforating holes in it. And then you run it down the sides and underneath the lip of the where your roof comes down. And that way, when there is a fire, you turn that on about 4 or 5 hours before, and your entire house is soaked. As a backup to that, make sure that you have a sprinkler system inside your house. And it's not expensive to install. It's easy to install. You can't even see it. And this way, when a certain temperature hits inside, it goes on. So now you're protecting your house from the inside and outside. Then if you want to go to a second backup system, a fallback, you then buy a fire retardant material. These come in large canisters, and you can spray them on your roof, and that will take a very high heat, and it won't burn. So that's the second protection. It'll take about a half hour, depending upon the size of your house. You should always have during fire season a roof that has a ladder to it. Then put sprinkler systems with high sprayers and risers over your entire lawn. And if you live where you do, I would clear trees back at least 100 feet. I realize that may change some of the aesthetics of the enclosed, but if you have totally soaked ground, and that's what the sprinklers do, they will soak the ground, then the flames from 100 feet away getting to your house are going to be less. And otherwise, what happens is the grass is so dry between leaves, brush, and grass, fire burns right up the carpet, right up into your house, and then it destroys your house. So I haven't had any destruction from fire because that's what I've done. I'm suggesting others do the same. I also suggest that you buy a fire suit for each member of the family and a fire suit for the dog or cat and a fire protective case. This is fireproofing with fireproofing gloves, and it's very lightweight. And you have a hood, just like you would see when someone's testing flammables. So this way you could actually go into a burning building or get out of a burning building and not end up burned to death or severely burned. Then get yourself a truck. Now, I have a 350 Ford truck I drive, and that's the biggest truck outside of a commercial truck that you can get. It has a 25,000-pound payload, a diesel. But also get yourself a long trailer, 18 to 22 foot, and with a guardrails on it of 8 foot. Now, this way you have your trailer, and trailers are not expensive. You can get a good used trailer. I just bought a used trailer for $3,000 that's looks like new. And you have it there in your garage or beside wherever you're going to store it. And when you know that there's a fire in your area, you take all of your most important and expensive or personal valuables, and you stack them with a dolly on your trailer. Then all your most important paperwork, your photographs, birth certificates, letters, anything that you emotionally attach value to. Then you get two large 55-gallon containers of gasoline or diesel so that you could go for 500 miles, 1,000 miles without stopping for gas. Because when there's big fires and there's flood, there's hurricane or tornadoes, you may not be able to have a place where you can refuel. Also have yourself a cabinet on there, a sealed cabinet where you can store dried food, dried fruits and vegetables, dried protein powders, and always have a portable water filter. I have one. So if I have no other source of water, I can go out to a swimming pool and fill it up, and that will clean out everything in that pool. If I'm in the woods, I have a river. Again, it will filter everything that's dangerous in the river. I can drink it. That's survivable because no one ever thinks to do these things. And Dane, I'm sure you've seen too, especially in California, where people will say, well, we didn't get out with anything about our lives. And I'm thinking, but you know you have fires around you. They're all around you. Why wouldn't you do this? And they didn't get a thing. Everything was lost. Pictures, valuables, everything. So they wait too long to make a move. Now, everything I just mentioned is not that expensive. And a lot of times you won't be covered fully for fire if it's destroyed. So if you have a trailer and a truck, if you know what you're going to take and you have a simple list, if you have protective gear, and you have a water system inside and out with fire retardant material and a sprayer, then at least you have an opportunity not to be the place that gets destroyed. And if it does come, it's less likely to do serious damage because the sprinkler is going to be on in and out. That substantially protects things, and you're getting your most valuable stuff out and away. I just wanted to share that with you. Your thoughts, please.
You know, if along with that, Gary, another plan B is this. $700 Honda high pressure water pump, a few fire hoses, about $100 a length, and a nozzle. If people have a water tank, which is not very expensive, you can put it in any residential neighborhood, or especially if they have a pool, in most cases, they would absolutely be able to defend their home with that one pump and one fire hose, period, if they have a water source there, even if the power's out, even if their water's out, which can happen in a neighborhood, which renders some of the other systems dysfunctional. If you have a gas-powered water pump, again, $700-$800, and you have a fire hose, and you have a water source, whether that's a plastic tank you put on the side, 500 to 1,000 gallons. Fire trucks only carry 500 gallons, so people know. Most fire trucks only hold 500 gallons, but that is a lot of water. Could certainly take care of most any dwelling fire as fires move in, as long as you're not socked into the center of a completely dead, dried-out forest. And, Gary, that's where the problem lies with this. These fires are not going to get better. They're going to get far worse. This is the alarm I have tried to sound for a decade and a half. Given the climate engineering operations, this had to happen. It couldn't not happen. And we have the myopic approach of the military-industrial complex. Gary, you know water vapor is also a greenhouse gas. But it's much more than that. We have to have atmospheric relative humidity and precipitation to keep the forests alive so that they are carbon sinks and not carbon sources, which they have now become. The boreal forests and northern latitude forests and tropical forests have now turned from carbon sinks, absorbing carbon, to carbon sources because they are dying. And this is one of the aspects of climate engineering in their tunnel vision view to reduce atmospheric relative humidity to try to slow down the warming. But in doing so, what else do they do? And the chain reaction of downstream consequences are exponentially worse than what they're trying to mitigate. And, Gary, this is very important. Weather is being used for warfare on any and every country that does not conform with the U.S. hegemonic dictates. From all the Middle Eastern countries, every single one that was named 1 week after 9/11 have undergone a once-in-1,000-year drought. And, Gary, I think you've probably seen the Iranian military has just stated again, they've stated it for the last 6 years, that the precipitation to their country is being systematically cut off by NATO weather modification, weather warfare programs. So I want to stress to your listeners this, simply this, and again, I've lectured on global warming before I focused all on climate engineering because I felt it to be the superseding issue. Mathematically, it is. But quite simply, there can be no legitimate discussion about the climate without including climate engineering first and foremost. And there could be no legitimate discussion about climate engineering without including a process called chemical ice nucleation for weather modification. For those people on the East Coast, in some regions that just had their coolest July on record, while we had the hottest July on record in the West Coast, these weather whiplash scenarios, freeze-fry scenarios, where in most cases the eastern U.S. is kept cooler because that's where most of the U.S. population is, which confuses and divides that population in regard to the true state of planetary meltdown. So this is a psychological operation in many ways, Gary, to mask the true severity of planetary meltdown, of climate collapse until the last possible moment. So yes, we can defend our homes. We should. There's some very simple ways to do that. Again, a water source, a water pump, and a fire hose can do an awful lot. If it's an inch and a half fire hose, that's 75 gallons a minute. That's about 10 the strength of 10 water hoses going at once. You can defend a house with that. But at the same time, if we don't stand back and understand that the planet itself is going down by the day, and the equation is as nonlinear as it can possibly be, and the environmental groups are not acknowledging the true severity of biosphere implosion, nor are any official agencies, nor is the IPCC. You referenced at the beginning of this program the methane scenario. We are perhaps 4 to 6 weeks away from an ice-free Arctic, first time in 3 to 4 million years. It's likely to happen this year. If it doesn't happen this year, it will certainly happen before the end of next year. That will make the equation even more exponential. We're already seeing temperatures that are being radically underreported. What's that mean? It means it's far warmer than we're being officially told. And I would challenge your listeners to check temperatures on their own. They'll see official readings are far lower than the actual readings on the ground. We're in far more dire straits at this very moment than people understand. So that's why we're trying to bring the climate engineering issue to light, bring it to a halt, allow the planet to respond on its own, allow populations around the globe to understand this is not a political issue, it's reality. The climate's imploding.
Dane.
Yep.
Dane, during the last program, you made reference to geoengineering manipulating the hydrological cycle, and I believe that would mean to push moisture towards the Arctic and explain the normal hydrologic cycle and how is this being altered and thus far from what we've been told is going to impact the flow of moisture around the nation and even Canada.
When climatologists and official sources claim that the jet stream variations, which are part of what pushes moisture toward the Arctic or not, and pushes it away from other zones like the North American West Coast, the upper-level wind currents are also, Gary, being manipulated by ionosphere heater facilities like HARP. Many of your listeners have probably heard of HARP. HARP is an ionosphere heater, and there are perhaps 100 such facilities around the globe. We're still not certain of the exact count. These facilities, by beaming massively powerful microwave transmissions into the ionosphere, causing an electrical chain reaction, heating the ionosphere, that's an electrical charged layer of the atmosphere, they can and are creating high and low pressure zones. So, Gary, picture, the listeners can picture looking at the front of an engine where you have a fan belt, and the fan belt circulates clockwise around some pulleys, counterclockwise around others, and that's what the jet stream does. Northern hemisphere, it spins clockwise for a high pressure zone. Low pressure zone spins counterclockwise, so they can steer the upper level wind currents and put the moisture where they want. At this point, the high pressure dome over the West Coast, picture that big dome like a big wheel spinning clockwise. The moisture goes right over the top of the whole U.S. West Coast, dives back down to the Gulf of Mexico around a counterclockwise rotating low pressure and picks up moisture and pumps it right up the U.S. East Coast like a swamp cooler. And then it pushes up towards Greenland. They're manipulating the flow of moisture. The climate engineers choose where it rains and how much. And that's the fact of the matter.
Okay. What is the composition of these geoengineering formulas? You mentioned briefly barium and aluminum. And break down their different toxicities that should most concern us. And is the nanotechnology being used in this massive experiment?
Yes. We know we are dealing with nanoparticulates, and that makes these particulates exponentially more harmful. That's why they don't show up in all air quality testing. People ask, well, why wouldn't air quality metering show this? Because at best, air quality tests for PM 2.5, 2.5 microns, generally 10 microns. So the particles we're talking about are unimaginably smaller, and they go virtually under the radar, even though they're unimaginably more harmful. We all know, Gary, we have mercury in us from the coal-fired power plants, fillings, vaccinations. Now we have aluminum in us. There's no question about that. Every human test subject, we test hair, blood, urine, packed full of aluminum. Synergistic toxicity. When you combine each of these individually highly toxic metals, the toxicity can increase as much as 100 times, 10,000% worse. And we now have both of these metals in us, not to mention fluoride and strontium and other metals now that are part of this mix. We have, you mentioned Morgellons, we have polymer fibers that are a part of the patents and a part of the mix. Why would they use polymer fibers? To try to keep these metal nanoparticulates aloft in the atmosphere longer, a fiber mimicking a spider web. This is the description in scientific literature describing these materials. They have no regard for what they put in the atmosphere, no regard for the fact that every bit of what they put in the atmosphere settles down on us. All of it toxic. Again, it's not just what we inhale. It's being absorbed in the entire web of life because the nanoparticulates are highly bioavailable and highly bioaccumulative. So they're readily absorbed and they accumulate in all life forms. So, again, from every aspect, this has to be considered the single greatest assault in the web of life ever launched by the human race. And again, the manipulating upper-level air currents, Gary, that's associated with where it's sprayed more or less as well. You know, there's various climactic scenarios that they increase the aerosol operations in. And the West Coast is hammered very hard at this point.
Dane, I'd like for you to touch upon the ongoing debate concerning the need to conduct geoengineering with aerosols in the stratosphere in order to cool the planet for any length of time, which is above the toposphere that contains the majority of all greenhouse gases and is It's only about 9 to 11 miles high, depending upon where you're located vis-a-vis the equator, in order to cool the planet. Also, we should remember that the ozone layer is located in the stratosphere. And the official word is that there is no geoengineering in the stratosphere, yet I believe that you have found studies that show this is false. Are there certain dangers with our geoengineering in the stratosphere that should alarm us? And has it been shown to cool the planet at all? And are those other risks from this that we either know or suspect, or is there simply a grand experiment that might have more dire consequences that we can't even imagine at this time?
Of the tropopause and the beginning of the stratosphere varies very dramatically depending on what latitude you're at. In polar regions, the stratosphere can be as low as 25,000 feet. The official denial from academia is that we don't have the technology to disperse these materials in the stratosphere. That's an absolute lie. Again, stratosphere in some of the polar regions as low as 25,000 feet. We know that that's where geoengineering was first deployed some 70-plus years ago in the polar regions. Had a very profound effect initially until the negative effects began to kick in. Gary, I'm sure you remember that there was a period from 1945, when we know these programs were first fully deployed over the poles, to 1975, when the protracted warming that was already evident and acknowledged in 1945 seemed to level off till 1975. And some of the climate scientists actually were perplexed and wondering why the protracted warming hadn't continued. Now, we don't know how much of that was statistical manipulation, but we do have enough data to conclude that the initial effect of geoengineering over the poles did slow down the warming until the negative effects kicked in, i.e. destroying the ozone layer for one. Not that CFCs are not harmful, but geoengineering is a much bigger causal factor in regard to ozone destruction. So the denial of the climate science community as to climate engineering occurring because they like to claim officially that we don't have the technology to geoengineer in the stratosphere is absolutely a lie. And two, most of the geoengineering we see occurring is happening in the troposphere. In fact, as low as in latitudes as low as 40 north, we see tankers at 18 to 20,000 feet. That's not high at all. And again, we can speculate as to all the agendas being carried out, but the fact that climate engineering is occurring, we have film footage to prove it. We have photographs of the nozzles mounted on the pylons on the aircraft aimed into the exhaust engine jet stream. We have photographs of the interiors of the plane. The lack of acknowledgement of this issue by academia, Gary, is simply criminal.
Dane, I want to share with you now something that I believe is the greatest single threat to the planet, and no one is talking about it. There's no news stories on it. I'm right now, we met today, my whole production staff. We ordered new cameras. We ordered drone cameras because we have to get about 25,000 feet up to film all this over Russia and over Siberia. Russian scientists just in the last week have warned that the methane risk along the Arctic Circle is far worse than the IPCC forecast. And that's important. The permafrost is melting rapidly. Methane burps are occurring more frequently and releasing large amounts of the gas. And it's about a tenfold more powerful gas, which is methane, than carbon dioxide. And so from your perspective, is there any evidence that geoengineering is also contributing to the thawing of northern permafrost? Because once it starts, I want to put this in perspective. Once the methane, and there's over 300 of the giant gigatons of methane locked in Siberia, if there was just one burp of 5 gigatons, just 5, it would completely change the entire Earth's weather pattern in 24 hours. You go to bed one night, there's a big burp out of Siberia, and suddenly everything changes. We would exceed every single warning threshold by any scientist in climatology, and we would go into a death cycle. From that moment on, according to the world's leading authority on the Arctic and melting there, he says that if we have that 5 gigaton, we have 5 years left. Now, I'm also hearing from Guy McPherson and other climate scientists that the Arctic is melting far faster than any mathematical model had predicted. Greenland is melting faster, Alaska, the glaciers, the Himalayas, and Antarctica. They're all melting faster than any mathematical model, and we're finding new things out all the time. And also, just 2 weeks ago, it was reported officially that the conveyor belt that you were referring to that takes warm water from the equator area, brings it up around Northern Europe and around Ireland, Scotland, Greenland, and then brings cool water back down, that's slowing. But you know what they didn't say? They didn't say what would be the consequences of that conveyor belt slowing so much that it immediately trips an environmental disaster. You can tell us what that would mean. You and I know what that means. People listening may not. And finally on this, that they are downplaying the significance of the Arctic melting because, A, they don't want to scare people, and, B, once that methane in the tundras melt, the steppes melt, the Siberian Peninsula begins to melt, the gigantic boreal forest at the northern altitudes melt, the northern Canadian forests melt, meaning that the hard frozen ground for 12,000 plus years, when that thaws, from that thawing material is going to come trillions of methane bubbles, hundreds of trillions of methane bubbles. And all it takes is one big one. And it's more than possible because 5 separate scientists have not now said, yes, we have all this methane stored in the Arctic. And what's worse is the Arctic is one body, but you've got the northeastern area beyond the Arctic, and now you're over into Russia, and that's where it's the shallow. It's only 50 meters, about 150 feet or less. And that means that you're not going to have those cathrates dissipate in the water and become harmless by the time they reach the surface. If it's 2,000 feet down, yes, those will dissipate. When you have something 100 feet, 150 feet, no, you can get a full-fledged methane burst going into the atmosphere, and we are unprepared for it and the consequences to it. Have I overstated or understated any of it? And take it from there.
If I could add clarification, no, you haven't overstated, not at all. In fact, it's more severe than that. First, institutions like the IPCC, again, 2,000 of the world's top climatologists, largest scientific panel ever assembled any human subject in history, their job is not to tell the truth. Their job is to downplay, to pacify the population. They have not addressed methane, as I said earlier in the broadcast. They do not calculate climate feedback loops into their scenarios. In the case of methane, over a 10-year time horizon, methane is from 100 to 120 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. Over a 30-day period, it can be as much as 1,000 times worse. People do not understand the severity of what's unfolding. In regard to the amount of methane that is thought to be contained in the Laptev Sea in the Arctic alone, as much as 10,000 gigatons, if, as you stated, a small portion of this, if 50 gigatons released, and we think, Gary, it may have already happened, 50 gigatons, that's 1/200th of what's thought to be in that region of the Laptev Sea alone. That's 0.5%. That's a 400% increase on the overall greenhouse gas forcing effect right now. As you correctly stated, that would alter the composition of our planet virtually overnight. Methane is covering the planet right now like a layer of glass. Heat gets in, doesn't get out. Nighttime low temperatures, nighttime low high temperatures as opposed to daytime high temperatures, rising 3 times faster than daytime highs. Why? Because of the greenhouse gases, methane most specifically trapping heat. Climate engineering also trapping heat, making it worse. And you asked at the beginning of your line of questions, is climate engineering making the methane scenario worse? The answer is absolutely yes. As I stated, they are manipulating and altering upper-level wind currents. That, in turn, alters ocean currents, as you correctly stated. We now have warm water pumping even further up into the Arctic. Yes, the Atlantic Cavity is slowing down, but they've altered the direction of some of the currents, and now we have warm water pumping into the Arctic. We have sea temperatures in the Arctic, in some cases, 20 to 25 degrees above normal, as you correctly stated. That's melting methane deposits on the sea floor. It's very visible. Your listeners should look up Siberian methane craters, and they'll be shocked to see. I know you've seen them, Gary, the massive blowout craters that are visible on land. It's worse below the sea surface, far worse. Bottom line again, we are on track for what's called Venus syndrome. In the case of Mr. McPherson, scientist Guy McPherson, whom I know personally, unfortunately, although Guy is stating correctly the severity of and immediacy of climate collapse, Mr. McPherson is absolutely not telling the truth about the climate engineering issue, which he absolutely knows is going on. Now, I understand that he risks his paycheck and pension for telling the truth about that issue, but to not tell the truth about that issue is, in my mind, completely inexcusable. So I hope others in the science community stand together, forget about their job security, which won't matter much longer in the course we're on, and stand up and help us disclose this issue. And Barry, we already have, at geoengineering.org, we're working with three high-ranking former U.S. Air Force officers. Two of them are two-star generals, acknowledging the reality of the climate engineering issue. This is not a question, it's not theory, not hypothesis. This is absolutely real for anyone who bothers to look at the data. It's inarguable. So what we have, and I'll give this back to you, we have governments around the globe that long ago decided to commit the human race and the entire web of life to an experiment from which there is no return, with no environmental impact study, with no public disclosure. They know the liability they've already created is incalculable. They know populations would take to the streets with their pitchforks and torches when they find out this is going on. My push at geoengineeringwatch.org is this. If we can fully expose these programs, and for those in the military and their families, when they realize what they're participating in, their own demise, quite literally, we have a chance of stopping these programs and allowing the planet to respond on its own, allowing the hydrological cycle to resume on its own. We cannot match the miraculousness of nature. I know you would agree with that, whether it's the human body or the planet as a whole. And our interference with that natural process can only bring cataclysm, and that's what's occurring. So geoengineeringwatch.org tries to provide the materials, the data necessary for everyone to help us bring this issue to light. If we can bring it to light, we can bring it to a halt. If we can stop and allow the planet to respond, we would at least buy time.
I feel it's important, Dame, to, as a public service, to debunk some of the wilder claims of government or military actions and technologies such as laser weapons and water vapor technology that's adversely affecting the climate and whether the environment and the catastrophes we're witnessing, such as drought and wildfires and floods. And related to these fake stories or conspiracies is that the government or AstroTurf groups are intentionally planting them in the public sphere through the Internet. Because once you discredit one wild claim, anyone else in the same field could then be discredited. So what are some of the more common climate change and geoengineering hoaxes that we would or should ignore when we come upon them on the Internet or in the alternative media?
The false narrative that cooling towers are being used to put all the moisture in the atmosphere for storms, that mathematically couldn't be further from reality. I worked on cooling towers for Bechtel Power. They can be fed with a 4-inch water standpipe. You couldn't produce enough water vapor moisture in the atmosphere to wet a football field or much more with that. So that narrative is so incredibly patently false. I did a full video on that, Gary, that people can search geoengineeringwatch.org water vapor towers. They'll find that data. In fact, for any information your listeners want, if they search geoengineeringwatch.org methane, geoengineeringwatch.org drought creation, fires, they'll find the data they want. But that's one completely false narrative. Two, the whole directed energy weapon narrative, as you asked for. I challenge people to search the post I put up about a week and a half ago with historical photographs of fires going back to 1923 that look exactly, and by the way, 1923 was 37 years before the first primitive laser was invented. And the fires, the burns, the standing trees next to the burnt to the slab dwellings, exactly the same. People don't understand that trees like redwoods, for example, are nearly fireproof. They can be burned, but they do not burn because they don't have pitch or sap in them. They're highly fire resistant. That's why they live 2,500 years. People are at a point, Gary, where they're snapping at any narrative that is dangled before them, and that greatly harms the credibility of the climate engineering cause, which is frightening enough on its own. If we want to move the ball forward in this battle, if we want to have academia reach out to us to join with us in this battle to expose this insanity, we have to stand on credible ground. You're so correct in bringing that up. And I ask people to actually investigate facts and not leap at sensationalized conclusions, again, which absolutely harms the credibility of this critical cause.
You're listening to Dane Wigington, W-I-G-I-N-G-T-O-N, a geoengineering scientist, and we are talking about geoengineering. Now, there are many causes of global warming, and there are many ways of approaching it. 9 years ago, Richard Gill, who you've spoken with, my executive producer and I, and he's a scholar, we sat and we said, what is the biggest, the number one problem we're facing? Was it the economy? Was it the body politic? What was it? We looked at 40 different issues, and we both agreed that it was global warming. Then the issue was, how likely is it for people to become aware of this, want to know about this, or be interested in it? And then we realized they wouldn't be. But we decided then to do more broadcasts on environmental issues than any other radio program in American history, and we do it every day. And then with we're a major book on the environment and doing a major film on it right now, shooting all over the world, showing all of its complexities. It's not just one thing. At that time, there were 12 tipping points. Now there's over 40. And at that time, we were positing what would happen if one of those tipping points, like the conveyor belt we mentioned, or methane release, were to rise to a place where it could not be reversed. What would be the likely outcome? And I remember at the time we interviewed a person who's Jeff Goldblum's character in Jurassic Park, the chaos theorist. It was actually based upon him and at the University of California. And I filmed him and I asked him a simple question. Is there any reliable information to predict the future based upon the current models they're using? And he said no. And now he's being shown to be right. Virtually every mathematical model that they're telling us, well, yes, it's going to get warmer, but not for 100 years. Yes, the seas are going to rise, but only, you know, 1 centimeter a year. They're all wrong. Everyone has been proven wrong in their own literature. The trouble is they're learning nothing from this. So my question is this, and really think through this. Take your time to answer it. Because this is the foundation upon which everything we've been talking rests. Since we already now have over 14 tipping points that have tipped, nothing we're going to do is going to stop it. There are some things we can still do and should. But we're getting to a place where it's going to be everyone for themselves. The government is not going to do anything, no matter what they say. I don't care if you're a liberal government or a conservative government. They've all said things. No one's done a single thing. State government's not going to do anything because if they did, they would ruin their tax base. People would move out of their state if they said our state is no longer sustainable, like California or Florida or Texas or Oklahoma, Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, Indiana, Georgia, Alabama. These are not sustainable for the future. So we're not going to get honesty, and hence we're not going to get action. So give us your best guesstimate, realizing it's subjective, it's a hypothesis, of what you see happening right now we're seeing over the next 5 years as right now we're seeing over 100,000 extreme weather events on the planet each 12 months. And now look at this, because it hasn't been universal, meaning the society doesn't collapse all at once. It does so in bits and pieces over a period of time. It's protracted. But if you have one of these environmental catastrophes, one of these tipping points, suddenly the whole world could begin to change so rapidly that we would be completely unprepared to deal with it. Look over the next 5 years. What do you see, your best guesstimate?
Based on mathematics, with no speculation, no theory, or no hypothesis, I would be amazed if we reached the end of this year without major links in the chain falling out. What that means is the moment that the severity of what's unfolding can no longer be hidden from the population, our realities will change at that moment, and those in power are preparing for that moment. Let's not forget, Gary, that U.S. agencies like Homeland Security ordered 2.4 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition. That's for one purpose only. They absolutely know at the top what's coming. And again, mathematically speaking, we do not have 5 years. And I would be surprised, as I stated, if we make it to the end of this year without links in the chain falling out, what that means in the scenarios we already described. If we have a blue ocean event in the next 4 to 6 weeks, which is mathematically highly possible, if not probable, our reality will change at that moment. We have crop failures all over the globe. We have fisheries collapsing all over the globe. We have about $40 billion worth of food being exported right now to the U.S. from countries that are starving to death in order to keep our shelves stocked, to keep the American population pacified until the last possible moment. We are there. It's not off on the horizon. It's kicking in the front door right now. What we can do, and you're correct, you're completely correct. All the modeling is incorrect. It's all exponentially worse than we've been told, and it's here now. But here's the question. Here's the big variable that academia is not acknowledging. Climate engineering, if it was stopped and the planet was allowed to respond, that would buy us time. If we can do that, that would be a leap in the right direction. Can we salvage anything? And isn't that worth fighting for if we can? That would be my argument. And that's our premise at geoengineeringwatch.org. This is the single biggest hole in the bottom of the boat, climate change, collapsing climate, as you correctly stated, as Richard correctly stated. That decides how long we're here, more than any other issue right now. And the single greatest destructive factor being climate engineering.
I appreciate those insights, Dane. I would be more optimistic, but not euphoric. I see it this way. I see that there's probably about 5% of the American population who are aware of these crises and have, in a reasonable and responsible manner, been looking at where they could relocate, what are the best chances of having a quality of life at different countries like Ireland or other places that do have rain, will not be excessively hot, and will not have the rising sea level everywhere that we are going to see, or drought where you can't grow anything. So, but again, systems don't collapse altogether. It's a gradual process. The Mayan collapse, the Aztec collapse, Mesopotamian collapse, these are all over hundreds of years, and at the very least dozens of years. But I do see, and I would agree with many who say, that we have about maximum 12 years before we're feeling universal crisis, where there's hundreds of millions of people in Africa, probably around 350 million, probably another 200 million in the Middle East, from Turkey and Syria, and certainly Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, that will not be able to feed their populations, and the heat will be so hot and the energy demand so great that every time they use an air conditioning, it just contributes to global warming. Even if they create desalinization plants, they have the money to do it, the energy used to create desalinization is only good for about maybe a million people if you had three or four plants. They had the money, but then that creates more heat. So they're in a negative feedback loop. So they're in the wrong place at the wrong time in history. Then you look at South America with the deforestation of the Amazon, the great lungs of the planet and one of the greatest carbon sinks in the world. It's now you're getting a reverse of that carbon. At a certain point, we have to pay attention to ozone, because we get a thinning of the ozone. Now, anyone living in that area could not go outside. Nothing will live. No trees, shrubs, it'll all be burnt. You go outside for 10 seconds, you'd have a third-degree burn. And that could happen in different places. And so I'm looking at the fact that when societies collapse, it's like hunger. Not everyone will be hungry. Not everybody will be in a bad place. The rich have already been having meetings. You have no idea, if you're the average person, that there are millionaires, multimillionaires, and billionaires, and multibillionaires who've been meeting, including at Davos this year, where they were talking about where to live when the crisis comes, when the people start to panic, where are we going to go? And they're going to places that I've been suggesting to people a long time. Get into places that have good water, good soil, underground aquifers that are not polluted and clean and deep, and build greenhouses, build berm houses, build into this soil, not on top of the soil, and be with other people of a progressive mind. You don't have to rush to do it. You can take some time, plan it out, and do it properly. So when things get really bad, as they are in Louisiana and Mississippi and Florida, then you'll know that your plan B, your fallback position. And if you don't have a fallback position, you're in trouble. When the hurricane came this year to my home in Florida, I had a fallback position. I had my animal keeper, my caretaker. You take care of them. The primates, you put them in this particular building. You go into the barn, open the doors, open the windows, let the air go through so it won't create a vacuum and take the roof off. As a result, nothing was happening. But I even had a plan, a fallback position. If everything fails, fall back to this position. I had it laid out in stages. Now, maybe people think that's a little radical, but it's not radical when a hurricane category 4 is over your head and everything is being thrown at 150 miles an hour wind in every direction. Then you think, okay, I'm off the city water, I got my own pumps, got my own solar system, I'm okay, and I can help my neighbors. So I think that we should be looking at the reality of what you say and hope that what you say doesn't come true, and let's hope, but the reality is it probably will, and we will continue to inform people who are proactive what to do about it. Dane, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary.
Dane Wigington, I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Comedy Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good
recording, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
What's up?
Hey, man, what's your name?
What's
your name? What's your name?
My name.
Woo! It's everything,
it's everything.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some.